Hello, I'm Dr. Jeff Bunn. As a psychologist, I try to understand human behavior and the way the human mind works. That involves asking a lot of questions, but how do I know they're being answered truthfully? With recent advances in neuroscience, claims are being made that by scanning a person's brain, it's possible to establish the truth and nothing but the truth.
And what they're showing here is that certain areas of the brain, in particular in parietal and prefrontal cortex, are more active when these participants in the scanner are lying compared to when they're telling the truth. And you can see that these areas are...
The idea that the truth can be detected in the body goes back a long way, in fact and in fiction.
Well, the only thing the machine is for is to record the emotional reactions of an individual.
I've done nothing criminal. I entered an office by mistake and read a letter from Idle Curiosity. You cannot prove I'm a spy.
Idle Curiosity. Bah! I'll make him talk.
No! Give him a lie detector test.
I'll take a test gladly.
We place a blood pressure cuff about the upper arm of the subject.
Are you a spy for any nation on Earth?
And record the variations in blood pressure and pulse on this status.
No.
It's a very sensitive criteria for emotional reaction.
Great Minerva! His blood pressure record is regular as a ruler. He's telling the truth.
Beginning in the 20s, the newspapers seize upon the lie detector as an incredible apparatus that will see into the criminal soul.
There will be no jury, no horde of detectives and witnesses, no charges and countercharges, and no attorney for the defense. The state will merely submit all suspects in a case to the tests of scientific instruments.
100 years later, despite those hopes, machines still haven't taken over the administration of justice. Evidence from lie detector tests can't be used in American or British criminal courts. But with new brain scanning technologies, bringing a belief that we can actually see what someone is thinking, there are now new pressures on the legal system. Neuroscientist Stephen Rose is keeping a wary eye on recent developments.
There are two firms which have patented devices which claim to be able to do this. One's called brain fingerprinting, which measures electrical impulses from the brain, and the other's called no-lie MRI, which measures magnetic resonance imaging, that is, the sort that give the brain false colour pictures.
Everyone watches CSI and sees the advance of DNA and fingerprinting technology and things like that, and wonders whether brain technologies can do the same.
Geraint Rees is also a neuroscientist.
I think the reticence of neuroscience in this area comes about simply because we know that even at its current best, it's a long way short, and by a long way I mean hundreds or even thousands of times worse than the kind of DNA technology that we see in CSI.
Even so, brain imaging evidence has been used to convict in a court in India, though the case was later successfully appealed against. The idea that a machine could detect lies really took off in America in the 1920s. Ken Alder is professor of history at Northwestern University near Chicago and is the author of The Lie Detectors, The History of an American Obsession.
It gets first used in Berkeley, California. A guy named August Vollmer, he's the leader of police professionalization in the United States, and he actually wants to use the science to make the cops more law-abiding themselves, substitute this kind of new scientific interrogation for what was formerly known as the third degree, which was a way of getting information from people by beating them up. So he brings in forensic scientists, and he also gets one of his cops, who actually has a PhD in physiology from Berkeley, to develop an apparatus to interrogate criminal suspects. John Larson is his name.
What are the physiological measures that Larson argues can be used to detect these lies?
Blood pressure, heart rate, breathing depth. Later on, another will be added, which is galvanic skin resistance. It's basically a proxy for sweatiness.
These are a pair of electrodes. Clip them to the palm on the back of your hand to pick up the electrical changes.
That's the voice of Leonard Keeler, polygraph pioneer.
Now just face forward. Don't watch the machine.
Leonard Keeler was a high school student in Berkeley, California, when he kind of got a summer internship working with the Berkeley police, with John Larson and August Vollmer on this apparatus, and he became entranced by it. He later goes on to slightly modify the machine. He cleans it up, puts it inside a box, makes it transportable, and gets a patent on that device, and then really has an incredible career first in Berkeley and then later on in Chicago, where he is one of the founding members of Northwestern University's Scientific Crime Detection Lab, which is the first full-scale scientific laboratory in the United States devoted to crime solving. He was a real engine of publicity and knows how to drum up reporters' support and travels around the country, very effectively solving incredibly high-profile cases.
Keeler was so famous by the 1940s that he could play himself in a Hollywood movie starring Jimmy Stewart. Call Northside 777 was directed by Henry Hathaway.
I'm going to try an experimental test now. I want you to take one of these cards, look at it.
He developed something he calls the card trick, which is a simple way before the formal examination begins, but after the subject has been strapped into the apparatus, he will show them a deck of cards and say, pick a card, any card, standard sort of card trick move. And then he'll flip over the cards one by one and ask them, while they're being recorded, to deny in each instance it's their card.
I want you to say no to each card that I ask, including the chosen card. You understand?
Yes, sir.
Did you choose the seven of clubs?
No.
And then afterwards, he will look at their bodily's response and say, look, you know, the card you picked, it was the four of clubs. And they'll be amazed.
You took the five of diamonds, Frank.
Yes, sir.
It gets him to provide information on what does a person's physiological response look like when they're lying. He's asked them to lie. They've lied, and he's picked it out. And secondly, and in fact, far more importantly, he's convinced them he can catch them in a lie. Because to some extent, the lie detector needs to be thought of as a kind of placebo effect. I mean, it works to the extent people think it works. This is today called the stimulation test. I mean, it's a way of stimulating the person so that they believe that they will be caught, and that really increases the chances they'll be caught. And the other thing about it is that Keeler was an excellent amateur magician. He always knew what the card was, even independent of the polygraph reading.
So the stimulation test sounds like a very polite name for it, but what you're essentially saying is there's a certain amount of magic involved, or at least deception.
Absolutely. So, famously in the United States, police officers are allowed to lie to suspects in crimes in order to extract information. In some sense, the lie detector fits right into that whole idea. You know, you were to catch liars to some extent with trickery and deceit, and that was considered okay.
One of Keeler's students at the Northwestern Crime Detection Laboratory was a young cartoonist called Chester Gould.
He is the creator of the cartoon character Dick Tracy, which is the largest syndicated comic strip in the United States for several decades in the middle of the 20th century. And the character of Dick Tracy is this uncorruptible, square-jawed cop who fights crime and corruption and is modeled in many ways on Keeler and several other of the members of the lab. Chester Gould endows him with all this, you know, technological apparatus to help him fight crime, including lie detectors, which feature very prominently in early strips. I mean, again, it's part of what makes the lie detector work, convincing people that it works. So that can happen at the level of the individual test, where the examiner does so by using things like the stimulation test. But it has to happen at a popular culture level, too. The American public has to be convinced that this technology works. And in odd sorts of ways, cartoons and comic strips are part of the way that happens.
Dick Tracy was very much based on Gould's vision of the ideal policeman.
Garen Roberts was a family friend, and he's written a biography of Chester Gould.
Literally, the square jaw that Gould drew on Dick Tracy represented his kind of unflinching morality.
When you say he was an upstanding character, was his use of science and scientific methods part of that calling?
Absolutely. He worked very, very hard on learning this kind of thing, because he wanted to depict the actual sciences.
So this is the era of fingerprinting, of ballistics, of blood splatter analysis, and I suppose one of the achievements of the era was the invention and development of the lie detector.
Mr. Gould predicted and used a number of scientific technologies and inventions before they actually became practical. His most famous, of course, was in the mid-40s, when he developed the wrist radio. That's the invention most often associated with Dick Tracy. But as early as the first couple of years, he did use forms of lie detectors in his storylines. He used even things like truth serums.
Some people have suggested that Dick Tracy kind of embodied the spirit of the Scientific Crime Detection Lab. He was the kind of poster boy for that whole agenda of using science to solve crime.
He was the pioneer of identifying and using and accurately portraying scientific inventions. There is no comic strip that is more culturally and historically representative than Dick Tracy, because Gould constantly reflected the scientific, the historical, the social context and situation in which he was found.
Well, there's nothing much here to investigate.
No? Okay.
I mean, the great American game is poker, right? And that's a game in which people are playing the odds, but they're also bluffing. And one of the things Keeler was great at doing was bluffing people into confessing. So there's some data that he gathered from fellow police officers that he had trained who operated around the country, and it's quite an extensive amount of data, and the police have never released this, but in the archives, it's there, and I found it. Keeler is able to get 60% confession rates by bluffing people. Whether those confessions are true is yet another question, right? You have to corroborate it in theory. But an examiner in Milwaukee once said that, you know, in responding to Keeler's question, well, you know, I was able to get a bunch to confess to the crime. In fact, four people confessed to the crime even before being strapped into the lie detector. Just the threat of the lie detector was enough. Or five, he says, if you count the one who committed suicide. The ruse is that it's the machine that's making the judgment. But in practice, right, it's the discretion of the examiner.
While Keeler achieved his 60% confession rate, his colleagues could only manage 6%. Keeler was arguably the inspiration for one crime-fighting comic book hero. And his main competitor in the field of lie detecting, a Harvard psychologist called William Moulton Marston, was the creator of another.
William Moulton Marston was an amazing individual. He really did have a couple second acts in his life. So his first was as a psychologist and a lawyer, an advocate for the lie detector. But he would later go on to be the creator of the cartoon superhero Wonder Woman.
Here's a secret report that may put five rubber magnates in jail, and I catch Elva Dove, a file clerk, reading it.
Elva? That handsome brunette? She wouldn't do anything wrong. The lie detector will prove it.
I'll ask you questions. Answer truthfully, or your blood pressure curve will go up. Elva, did you take that rubber report from the secret files?
No! No!
Well, I'll be jiggered. She is lying.
We're here in Travelling Man, comic book shop in Manchester. And even now, 70 years on, there's a huge interest in Wonder Woman. Lots of recent comic books and histories and books about Wonder Woman on display. And I'm here with Joan Ormerod from Manchester Metropolitan University.
She was created by William Marston, and he created her from the point of view of myth and legend of ancient Greece. So she's sort of born of clay. She's made from a clay statue by Hippolyta, Queen of the Amazons, and she lives on this paradise island. And she's given all these gifts by the gods, a bit like Sleeping Beauty.
So Marston invented the lie detector, and he equips Wonder Woman with a lie detector of her own, the golden lasso of truth.
It compels people to tell the truth, which is slightly different from a lie detector. However, he does write the lie detector into one of his stories in 1942, one of the early issues of Wonder Woman, in which she finds a spy.
Marston seemed to be obsessed with deception, lying, subterfuge, false identities. Is that a common theme in the early stories?
You've got to remember this is Second World War, and in the Second World War everyone had to be vigilant and not let secrets out. But then after Second World War you get the Cold War, and again secrecy is also very important. So you get another story with a lie detector in 1947, and you get continuous stories of lie detectors in Wonder Woman and Superman. I think the accessories that she has do link into quite a lot of fetishistic things, and her bracelets.
These are the famous bracelets of submission.
Indeed, yeah.
And I believe Marston had an interest in submission, both intellectually and, I suppose, perhaps even practically.
Yeah, he had a very interesting relationship with women. He lived with his wife and his mistress was the inspiration behind Wonder Woman, really. I think her name was Olive. He lived with these two, and then when he died in 1947, they continued to live together until they died. So, yeah, he believed in loving submission and domination. So they must have had a very interesting life together.
Marston was obviously an unusual personality. He took the lie detector into the world of fantasy, but he also believed the machine had wider uses in the real world.
What are the facts about razor blade quality? That's what Gillette wanted to know. And that's why Gillette retained Dr. William Moulton Marston, eminent psychologist and originator of the famous lie detector, to conduct scientific tests that reveal the whole truth. Truck drivers, bank presidents, men in every walk of life, strapped to the lie detector, the same instrument used by police, these men shave while every reaction is measured and recorded.
He's a hard guy to read. He's absolutely serious about what he's doing at one level, but I think he's also just enjoying it. And there's always an element of a joke behind him. His whole study on blondes, brunettes, and redheads, I have never figured that out.
Blondes lose out in film love test. Brunettes far more emotional, psychologist proves by charts and graphs.
Marston worked for Universal Pictures in Hollywood, testing audiences' emotional reactions to movies with his love detector. He went on to find even more applications for it.
Dr. William Moulton Marston, the inventor, reports success with his device in solving marital or other domestic problems, and adds that it will disclose subconscious secrets of which the subject is utterly unaware.
General questions on an infidelity test is, have you had sexual intercourse with anyone while you've been married? Anyone else while you've been married? Have you had sexual contact with anyone other than your wife while you've been married?
Bruce Burgess runs Polygraphs UK, one of the few companies in Britain that offers lie detector testing.
I mean, the most common test that we do is probably infidelity testing, but the second most common test is child abuse. When a child makes an accusation against the alleged perpetrator, we will test the alleged perpetrator.
And what do you do with the results of the test?
So initially, I just give them to the person we test, and we can talk to anyone they allow us to talk to. We make it clear that if we have an admission of any criminal activity, we're obliged to contact the police and we will give the results of the polygraph to the police.
What do the police think of the polygraph evidence, given that there hasn't really been a tradition of polygraph use in this country?
In those cases, the police do come down and take a statement from us.
What's the opinion of the British courts about lie detector polygraph evidence?
Well, it isn't used in courts. I have given evidence in civil court, but in criminal court, it's yet to happen.
And the same is true in America. Ken Alder.
Lie detectors are not allowed to be used as evidence in a criminal trial, but they're used in increasingly large numbers in criminal investigations, but that evidence can never be used in trial. So why are they using them? The answer is that, in fact, they're using them to extract confessions, which are admissible in court. So if in the course of a lie detector exam a person actually admits to something, that evidence is allowable in court, and that's what really makes the lie detector thrive. It thrives in that shadowy part of the criminal justice system that's, you know, not the trial, but only 10% of cases or so go to trial. The vast 90% are resolved prior to the trial.
Popular visual culture, like comic books and film, has promoted public faith in the polygraph. And now, colourful computerised images of the brain are fueling a belief that neuroscience can deliver the ultimate lie detector.
I'm Geraint Rees. I'm director of the UCL Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience. We study mental processes in the human brain.
This experiment that we're looking at here is a test called the guilty knowledge test, where people are asked questions about items on their CV, some which can be independently verified as truth, and some on which the subjects have an incentive to lie. And what they're showing here is that certain areas of the brain, in particular in parietal and prefrontal cortex, are more active when these participants in the scanner are lying compared to when they're telling the truth.
I'm Stephen Rose, and I'm Emeritus Professor of Neuroscience at the Open University. I think the real problem is that what constitutes a lie is in itself not a very simple and straightforward statement. it is possible under very controlled laboratory conditions to use a brain imaging technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging, where people are put into a tunnel and their brains are being imaged, and they're then asked to deliberately tell a lie. Under those controlled circumstances, the claim is that you can actually detect when someone is telling an untruth. But in real world, that ain't so.
I don't want to be over-optimistic here that we're going to come up with some all-singing, all-dancing, brain-reading, lie-detecting device. This is extremely unlikely now or in the foreseeable future. What we can't do is say because a particular area of the brain is active, therefore the person was doing something like lying. Any brain area does multiple things, several different things. So, for example, an area of the brain called the insula, when it activated in one famous study, was taken to reference the people lying in the brain scanners' disgust at seeing particular politicians. And it is true that the insula is activated by disgust. But it is also activated by extreme sexual pleasure and by eating chocolate.
The problem of this, what I can only describe as internal phrenology, the idea there is a specific site in the brain associated with belief in God or romantic love or indeed telling lies, is fundamentally to misunderstand the way that the brains work. Brains work in a highly dynamic, distributed sort of way. The fact that a particular region lights up doesn't mean that that is a region which actually is, if you like, a God spot. Let me give you a very simple example. In the old days, when radios had transistors and you were playing a Beethoven symphony, if you took out a transistor and you got the howl rather than a Beethoven symphony, it didn't mean that the function of the transistor was where the Beethoven symphony was located. All you're looking at is the functioning of the system in the absence of the transistor. And that's exactly what's happening in the context of the brain, and that is these are widely distributed processes in which many bits of the brain may be involved and may light up at particular times.
I suppose if I tell a lie, I feel nervous and anxious, and that lie must be encoded in my brain in some sense. Is it not implausible to think that in the future there will be a technology capable of detecting that lie?
Well, you're a good person and therefore will feel anxious when you're actually telling a lie. I'm a poker player and I try to bluff and to convince people that I have a better hand than I have, or sometimes a weaker hand than I have. I'm sure that's registered in my brain, because everything we do is in some sense is registered in our brain. But whether we'll be able to detect using any sort of a cerebroscope or any sort of machine, this is a lie, that is not a lie, I would doubt very much.
These criticisms pretty much echo those made about the original polygraph. Ken Alder again.
I actually am interested in explaining why, despite many other very serious objections from scientific bodies like the National Academy of Sciences, which published a devastating report a few years ago condemning the lie detector as inadequate and insufficiently proven, why, in spite of this continuous scientific debunking, does it persist?
And what have you concluded?
Well, that it appeals to a certain ideal of justice, actually. It's a way to turn away from human judgment and try to look for fairness. And this idea that this neutral arbiter could resolve our most pressing social problem, guilt and innocence, is one that's enormously appealing. And until you understand that, I think people in turning the lie detector actually have kind of a noble ambition to transcend human prejudice, you won't get what's so appealing about it. The problem, of course, is it doesn't really transcend human discretion and human judgment. The results still have to be interpreted, and that interpretation varies enormously.
I think I'm more worried about the new images, because whereas the traditional polygraph, you can see, is not actually submeasuring something directly in the brain, but some autonomic response, some skin response. And so the brain images are likely to be more convincing.
Would you agree that these technologies are very intimidating in the popular mind, and that's partly perhaps why they're being promoted?
I think the technologies are intimidating. I think the reasons for exploring them in the context of wars conducted by British or American governments or conducted by the terrorists against British and American populations we live in an increasingly fearful society, and I think these are grounds for the technologies being explored in this sort of way. The fact that they're being explored, the fact that they are being sold as providing certainty about whether someone is lying or not, is in itself an important aspect. It doesn't, the fact that technology doesn't work doesn't mean it won't be used and doesn't mean it won't be misinterpreted.
The quest to find the truth continues. And with the threat of global terrorism, today the stakes are even higher. But bearing in mind the evident limitations of the lie detector that Wonder Woman and Dick Tracy grappled with, perhaps we need to be even more vigilant about not placing our faith in fantasy. I'll leave the last word on this to another fictional detective, G.K. Chesterton's Father Brown.
"I've been reading," said Flambeau, "of this new psychometric method they talk about so much, especially in America. You know what I mean. They put a pulsometer on a man's wrist and judge by how his heart goes at the pronunciation of certain words. What do you think of it?"
"I think it very interesting," replied Father Brown. "It reminds me of that interesting idea in the Dark Ages that blood would flow from a corpse if the murderer touched it."
"Do you really mean," demanded his friend, "that you think the two methods equally valuable?"
"I think them equally valueless," replied Brown. "Blood flows, fast or slow, in dead folk or living, for so many more million reasons than we can ever know."
The Truth and Nothing But the Truth was presented by me, Dr. Jeff Bunn, and the readers were Ben Crowe, David Seddon, and Philippa Stanton. The programme was produced by Maria Burgess.